Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's speech today in Minneapolis in front of a backdrop of police officers where he kicked off his public campaign to reduce gun violence in America. Lawrence Jacobs, the Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota, joins us to discuss what steps have been taken to reduce gun violence in Minnesota and whether the President can get enough of the public behind him to stand up to the NRA. Then we will speak with one of the leading authorities on the delivery of power to large populations, David Freeman, the former head of the TVA, New York Power, and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Following the half-hour blackout in the middle of the Super Bowl, we will discuss our dependence on electricity from an aging grid that will be subject to more and more stress in the future from extreme weather caused by global warming that is in turn caused by, to a great extent, by the use of coal to generate electricity. Then finally, we will speak with the organizer of a public campaign, My Jihad, which seeks to recapture the proper meaning of the word jihad that has been expropriated by Muslim and anti-Muslim extremists alike. Ahmed Rahab, the executive director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, joins us to discuss his campaign that has already begun with advertisements in subways and on buses in Chicago, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. Joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you again.
And the city that was once called Murderapolis, because of its high homicide rate in the 1990s, was chosen by the president to sort of kick off his public campaign to try and get enough people to have enough wind at his back so that he can get some parts or something related to gun control passed in this Congress. Tell us what took place over the years in Minneapolis to attract the president to make his stand there and also pay homage, if you will, to what Minnesota's doing.
Well, Minnesota, as you mentioned, there was an explosion of violence related to drugs and to gangs, and it was a pretty widespread set of local efforts in the communities. Nonprofits got involved. And then in terms of the city, there was a series of programs that tried to rehabilitate young people who had committed violent crimes. The result is we've had a pretty significant drop by more than a third in violent crimes in Minneapolis since the mid-1990s. It's a perfect backdrop for the president's message today that we can't do it all, but we should do something.
And he certainly had a phalanx of police officers behind him. I guess today would have been a good day for a crime if you're a felon in Minneapolis, right? That looked like every cop was there in the background.
Yeah, there's pretty broad support in Minnesota among the sheriffs and the police for common sense efforts to rein in the availability of drugs. For instance, near where the president was giving his talk, during the summer, the police were picking up about a gun a day on average. And the police don't see that as a good story. So they're looking for ways in which we can make further progress in Minnesota to rein in that availability of guns.
Well, I was speaking the other day to a filmmaker, an author, who made the film The Interrupters, which was a PBS Frontline special on a group of ex-gang members in Chicago that try to stop violence, gang-related and gun violence in the south side of Chicago. And he pointed out that almost all the guns that the police pick up, the so-called crime guns, in this tremendous amount of fratricide going on inside in the inner city community there in Chicago, Most of them, over 50%, according to the police, are bought in the outer suburbs of Chicago, and most of them at one particular gun dealer's shop. But the reason that the police can't go after these gun dealers is because the NRA has made it all but impossible for the ATF to trace, track, and share information with other law enforcement organizations about crime guns.
Well, this is certainly one of the areas where the president is focused in terms of background checks that would be universal, the banning of assault weapons, the limits on the magazines that are used for the assault weapons and other guns. And, you know, I think in Minnesota, which is very important to state, lots of folks here are hunters. This is a state that really takes pride in its very large rural areas. Hunting and fishing are very widespread. So this is not about Second Amendment, but you have the police and the sheriffs who said, you know, we're at war in some of these cities and some of the other areas. We need help. And so we're not going to have a, you know, kind of the perfect solution. But as we've seen in the last couple decades in Minneapolis, there's some things you can do that make a difference.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and The Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream. Let's turn to one of your books, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and The Search for Community. The president, of course, is trying to mobilize the majority of the American community. In a recent poll, 92% of Americans supported broader background checks. And in that same survey, found that 53% support a ban on automatic, semi-automatic weapons, and that 63% would support limits on ammunition magazines. How does the president organize a majority community in this country to give him the wind at his back that he needs to take on the National Rifle Association, whose members are quite zealous? There may be only 4 million of them, which is about 1% of the population. But my understanding is that the pro-gun control people don't have anything like the passions of the anti-gun control people. And that the anti-gun control people, this is a single issue to them. So if you cross them, you'll never get their vote. Whereas the pro-gun control people are interested in a panoply of issues. One among them being gun control.
Well, I think that's certainly true. That the intensity is very much on the side of, particularly the leadership of the NRA. It's interesting, some of the items you mentioned, such as background checks that would be broadened. There are a good number of NRA members who support that. After all, you know, they could become victims, and they don't want people who, for a variety of reasons, have already demonstrated that they've got evil in their heart. So I think what's interesting here is, in a way, there's a kind of a battle going on between America and this one organization. The president's trying to rally support around the country to make it demonstrable and very visible, as he was doing today in Minneapolis, to bring pressure on members of Congress to step up and take some votes against the NRA. There's a lot of paranoia out among members of Congress that the NRA is a potent force if you turn on them. The evidence is actually more mixed on that.
Well, give us some of that evidence, if you could, Lawrence Jacobs.
Well, for instance, in Minnesota, we have had some politicians who have stood up to the NRA, have gone on to win re-election. You know, it's based on other issues when the elections roll around. Of course, you remember back in the 1990s, Bill Clinton actually pushed through some significant efforts to regulate guns, and there were no real backlash from the NRA. So the NRA has got a very loud bark, but its electoral bite is quite a bit less.
But the president's only chance of getting anything through the Congress rests with the Senate. where he can then hope he can get the Senate, at least if the Republicans don't invoke the filibuster rule, which they've done a lot. And apparently Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell have made some kind of deal, although people aren't quite sure what it is. And those that wanted filibuster return to go back to before the 60-vote threshold was required seem to be quite disappointed by whatever this deal is. But nevertheless, it seems that the president has Harry Reid and the Democratic-controlled Senate to work with, and the only hope in the House is if you could at least get an agreement on an up or down vote. There's enough Democrats in it, with a few wavering Republicans, you may be able to pass something. That was the way that the fiscal cliff deal was done, and that seems to be, I would think, the only legislative blueprint the president has at his disposal. Would you agree?
You know, I think that could be the way this plays out, that you see legislation moving from the Senate. But I also think if you listen very carefully to the president and to Democratic leaders, what they're saying is we're going to find an area where Democrats and Republicans could come together. And it looks as if that area is going to be on broadening the background checks, probably the ban on assault weapons and the efforts to limit the capacity of the magazines. Won't make it very far. So I think, you know, the president is very clear today. He kept saying, we may not be able to do everything we want, but it's still worth doing something, because even if we can save one life, that makes a difference. So I think there's a kind of invitation to compromise that the president has delivered today in Minneapolis.
Well, I was going to say that that Harry Reid took down off his website the endorsement he had from Wayne LaPierre, who gave him an award for Harry Reid's stance on fighting the assault weapons bill and on being a staunch supporter of the assault weapons ban. He comes, of course, from a gun-toting state, Nevada. So. And beyond his own personal views, I'm sure Harry Reid's also very sensitive to some of the other Democrats in rural states that have a strong presence for the NRA. So how does explain to me then why you think the assault weapons ban isn't likely to pass. I assume that that has something to do with what we're just talking about here.
Yes, I think the there are going to be some moderate Democrats, whether it's Harry Reid or Senator Manchin from West Virginia, who are going to draw a line in the sand saying we're willing to move forward on this, but only so far. Even Barbara Boxer has come out and said that she doesn't consider the ban on assault weapons something that's going to happen this year. And the president is basically saying the same thing in general terms, that he doesn't want to see something go down, perhaps because it's filibustered. He wants to get something to pass. And if it's the broader background checks, maybe a few other things, he would be, you know, he'd take that and then try to build on it in coming months and years.
But so how does this work, though, in American politics, where you have a very, very vocal minority that seems to be able to, up until now, thwart the majority? And there was, of course, an assault weapon ban that expired recently, and it wasn't renewed under George W. Bush. It had a 10-year sunset, which was apparently slipped in the bill as they made these last-minute compromises forced by the NRA. So I'm just curious to know, as a political scientist, you know, this strikes me as minority rule gone mad.
Well, there's no doubt that powerful, well-organized interests have disproportionate power. And you can just go around the horn. You know, we just went through and still going through this tremendous recession that's left so many people out of work or underemployed, their assets stripped. And, you know, you look at what happened with the regulation of finance, and what was passed was watered down. Much of the Dodd-Frank legislation has not actually been implemented yet. So, yes, the powerful who are able to organize, put money into lobbying, into campaign finance, have a big advantage. But I would not take that to the other direction of saying, well, therefore, majorities don't matter. Because you do see when there are persistent sets of reformers who are smart, you do see inroads. And I think the 1990s with Bill Clinton and his success in passing gun regulation is one example. Health reform is another. I mean, that was resisted by private insurers and many others, and that was passed. So there is an advantage for the organized, but they don't, I think, dictate at the end of the day.
So, Lawrence Jacobs, tell us about the mayor of Minneapolis, R.T. Ryback Jr., who spoke today ahead of the president and really was pretty tough in a way that you don't often hear Democrats going after their fellow Democrats. He said, "I don't think any of us should accept anything other than complete efforts and knocking off the political wimpsmanship that I think too often takes place around these issues. Get a spine, get a backbone, because people are losing their lives." That was a pretty strong challenge to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, RT is a real stemwinder. He's not cantankerous in person. He's very, very pleasant in person. But in the political environment, he'll throw a punch. And on issues he cares about, he can be quite ferocious. Remember, this is a guy who's been in office for some time, and he is very active, very present in Minneapolis. He has been to the homes of many, many young people who have lost their lives to gun violence. Just this summer, there was a five-year-old who was fatally shot in his home. The bullet came through the house and hit him and killed him. And the mayor was there, and that is just one of many cases. So this is an issue that the mayor cares about passionately. He's lived it. And I think, you know, he's channeling some of the outrage that some folks who support much tougher gun laws are feeling and expressing. That's part of why the president made his visit, was to give a platform to some of those, you know, outraged American citizens and politicians.
Well, it seems an odd strategy, though, that his best chances might be to beat up on his own Democrats who are wavering and give them some backbone. I imagine it's going to be tough appealing to House Republicans.
Yeah, but a little bit of, you know, kind of populist pressure from the Prairie puts a little bit of a push in the back of Democratic politicians who think they may get a pass on an issue. And I think what RT was trying to convey is, you know, don't think this is going to be one of those issues that you're able to kind of finesse and wiggle your way out of. We're watching you.
Well, just in closing, you think, Lawrence Jacobs, that there's a chance, at least in terms of the in criminal background checks, it currently only covers about 60% of all gun sales. So you got 40% of gun sales that are unregulated already. Also, semantics seem to be very important to me. For example, the abortion battles, in many ways, the labeling pro-choice versus pro-life is very disadvantageous to those who support abortion rights, because pro-choice sounds sort of somewhat capricious compared to pro-life, which has more heft. And it seems to me that framing it around gun control is a terrible piece of semantics. Why can't they talk about gun safety or something else?
Yes, and it's a very good point. I think you've touched on something. What the president was doing today, and you commented on it at the outset, was to surround himself with sheriffs and folks in the police forces. What he's talking about is pro-safety. And he's doing everything he can to distance the effort to regulate guns from the kind of social liberalism that was often seen in the 80s and 70s and 60s that really was offensive to some people who, grew up hunting and found the campaigns to be offensive. So I think the president understands what you're talking about. If you listen to his language, it really is much more inclusive. He's very careful to acknowledge that there are differences. He talks a lot about looking for some steps of change, even if it's not the kind of ideal reform strategy that he would like to see.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you again.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a leading authority on the delivery of power to large populations, and it's because it wasn't Beyoncé's fault why the power went out at the Super Bowl.
But it won't be long, 'cause kids with guns, easy does it, they got something to say.
Now they're turning.